Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Good afternoon. This is Marcello Rolando, your host for the Reasonable Voices Talk Radio, where Reasonable Voices get to share their education and their information and themselves with all the rest of us. Today, my guest is Susan Schaller. Susan Schaller, that's S-C-H-L-E-R, is the author of A Man Without Words. And she's done a lot of things with languages and believes that language is a very strong bridge that links us all together. Susan, first of all, good afternoon. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing wonderfully in the sun here. How are you?
I'm just fine. Are you in Richmond, Virginia or North Carolina?
I'm in North Carolina, very close to Virginia.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. In any case, the reason I asked is because you mentioned the weather, and it's just gorgeous yesterday, and I'm going to try to get out of the studio today at some point. But tell us about yourself and the work you do with languages and with people, the vital signs. I know you've just finished retelling The Boy Who Cried Wolf and Hansel and Gretel for the multilingual ASL tales. You can start there or anywhere you like. Just tell us about yourself.
Well, I won't start. I was born in Wyoming, although I guess I did. where they don't talk much in Wyoming, so it's interesting that I'm interested in language.
Interesting.
Maybe it's because I didn't hear enough language when I was in Wyoming. Yep. They say yep a lot.
Uh-huh.
So the way that actually does relate is that human beings in general, don't think too much about language. Certainly when we're kids, we don't. We use our native language functionally. I'm hungry, I want to go out, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We're not thinking I'm using a subject or a verb or what language is. Mm-hmm. And my life was changed when I sat in front of a man who didn't understand what was going on, and very, very gradually, I realized this man didn't know what language was.
Oh.
He was a human being, so of course he has the cognitive abilities of any human being, and he is a very intelligent human being. So he has the beginnings in linguistics, beginnings of whatever the brain does to make grammar, structure, language. But according to linguists, you need to have a spark. You need to have a linguistic spark to make it a specific language, like English or Spanish or Japanese or American Sign Language. And he didn't have that spark because he was born profoundly deaf to hearing parents. And it's very, very easy to isolate deaf children in a hearing family, in a hearing society. And what that means is not having any language, not having exposure to language. They didn't expose him to a visual language, a signed language. And so he didn't know what was happening on mouths. And so back to myself, I never thought about language until I'm faced with a languageless person. And I thought, oh my goodness. And what came up for me was, how can you be human without a language? And to realize that I thought many things that were a part of me, I thought came from language.
Mm.
Like I thought ethics is something you have to learn through education, through your parents, through language. I believe this is the most ethical man I have, most ethical human I have ever met in my entire life.
Wow.
And he had no language for 27 years. And yet he had a strong, strong, strong sense of what's right and wrong and how to relate rightly to nature, to others, without language, without philosophy, without words, without knowing what words are. That was amazing. And I can go on, but I won't. Anyway, no. I was faced not only with language and the significance of language, but what it is to be human. And my life was changed by him, and my work and emphasis in life became the question, what can we learn from others? And the more different they are, this man was like a Martian to me. Sure. And yet I learned more from him about myself and about my humanity and my language than from any person, any book, any professor. And I started realizing how we all need to learn from each other. So as far as who I am now and what I've been doing for the last, I don't know how many years, the theme, the umbrella is how can we change our attitudes instead of looking at someone who's different from us and saying, oh, what's wrong with that person? Mm. What a funny last name, or what a funny skin color, or what a funny lack of an arm, or what, I mean, what's wrong with that person? Instead of asking that question, what can I learn from this person?
Mm-hmm.
I'm female. What can I learn from a male? I'm a Western American. What can I learn from a Southern American? I'm an American. What can I learn from a European?
Yes.
I'm a Western Hemisphere person, a Northern Hemisphere person. What can I learn from a South Hemisphere person?
Sure.
Whatever it is, whatever the difference is, we can learn about ourselves by meeting other people. That's become huge in my life, and it really drives all my projects. Because it's what's going to help us solve any problem. And the bigger the problem, the more obvious it is.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's global warming, whether it's poverty, whether it's war, no one language group, no one tribe is going to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
We need each other. And that means we have to bridge differences. We have to figure out, how do you think differently from me? And what is that difference going to do as far as maybe adding a piece of a puzzle in a solution? So I think it's huge. I think
it
it's
is
community
huge.
Building. I think it's what we need to do.
And you know, and you certainly hit it. I mean, I know you've for decades now, you've been doing public speaking and writing and film projects, advocacy for the importance of language, making us equal to one another and giving us equal access to each other and to language. Can you give us the man you're talking about, can you give us his name?
Well, in the book, I call him Ildefonso.
Ildefonso. Okay, love it.
And I've just gotten in the habit of calling him Ildefonso because now he has come out, so to speak,
yes.
Meaning that he's been on a documentary, so he's now somewhat public and gave up his anonymity for the first time in decades.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so used to calling him Ildefonso, I still call him Ildefonso.
Well, that's fine. That works for us. So Ildefonso, he did have his sight, which is different from Helen Keller. But you're making the point that for whatever reason, obviously his parents and relatives, those close to him knew he could not hear, but they were not in a position to teach him sign language or whatever, but they must have done a lot of indicating. But from this, I think that the thing that's hit me is that without any kind of, not formal education, I guess, but without any education in language, as you say, if I'm understanding you correctly, not even knowing that language was a thing made up of words that named things and emotions and people and countries, etc. So if he didn't have that and he wasn't taught how to lip read, yet somehow he has a tremendous moral fiber and sense of right and wrong and honesty. How is that? Did he get that just by watching Honest Family Members? I mean, talk to us about that a bit.
Well, that's somewhat of a mystery because I've asked him 100 times to explain what his life and his thinking was like before he learned language, and he's better now, but he still pretty much says, well, that's when I was an imbecile. That was, you know, basically he describes the dark ages.
Uh-huh.
And then he says, I'm not interested in that. I want to tell you about language. And I said, well, actually, we know about language because all of us, most of us, learn it as a baby, and we don't remember being languageless. And so we're really interested in what it would be like to think without language. And he thinks we're crazy. He thinks we're crazy. But that's the bad time, and I want to tell you about the good time. And so we go in circles constantly over that question. And the way it relates to what you're asking is I can't really directly get at how did you come up with this conclusion? How did you do the... he doesn't want to answer those questions. One interesting bit that he has said is I think differently. I can't remember how I used to think because language has changed me. And he says that the way he says it, he doesn't say it in those words. What he says is that he can't talk to his friends who are languageless because he did find... I think this is amazing. People found each other. They knew that they were alike, and they didn't know how that was. They didn't know what their difference was. They didn't know that they were deaf. They didn't know that they were languageless, but they knew that they were alike somehow and different from most of the people that they met. And I think that's fascinating. That's a whole other book.
Yes,
indeed. Someone else maybe needs to write. But he says I can't talk to them anymore because now he's so frustrated at the miming and the charades and the kind of ways that they try to communicate. It's described in the last chapter, or what was the last chapter, now it's the second to the last chapter of our book.
Which is A Man Without Words, yes.
Right, and it's fascinating. I felt like I was watching the beginning of the first language on Earth. I thought this must be how it started. He says he can't do that anymore because he now knows that you can go much faster with something called a sentence, with names that can point to things, with time references that you can talk about the past or the future. You can't do any of that in what this miming charades game that they were doing. So I find that fascinating, that his brain has changed. So language does change our brain.
Yes.
Back to your question, though, what I do know about him just watching him, he observes. So what did he do for 27 years? He watched and he watched and he watched. He was on the outside watching. He didn't give up, so he studied, and he was studying people and studying things. And so as you said, yes, he saw people being greedy. You can see hoarding. You can see people building castles. You can see people getting larger and larger pieces of property.
Sure.
And you also see people being content with what they have, a little tiny plot, a little tiny hut, and they're content and happy, and they share what they have. They could see that kind of thing. And he made the conclusion without language that the whole world would be so much better off. In fact, everyone would be happy if we were all just content with our own little garden and our own little place and didn't try to get more than we needed. That's what I mean by ethics. I mean, he had that without language. He concluded that without language.
By observing the human race. I can understand that. So
he saw not war as we know it from the TV news, but he certainly saw a lot of things that were, you know, mini wars, or I'm sure he did see stuff on television that he would probably, you know, I mean, destruction, bombs, see stuff, and he links that to people trying to get more and thinking they deserve more and not being content, and he linked that without language. And the reason I know this is without language is that something came up when I was teaching him, and he didn't have language. He had maybe 7 words and 10 signs, but only had names. He didn't know what language was, as far as grammar, structure, or all he knew was that, oh, everything has a name. He got to that breakthrough. That's all. And at that time, he starts miming something to me. And mime is a lot of guesswork. And it's even more guesswork than charades, because charades points to words, and he didn't know how to do that.
Yes.
So I'm guessing, and what I guessed was what I told you, that if everyone was content with a little tiny place and a little tiny plot, a little tiny garden, the world would be a better place, you know, less fighting, whatever he mimed. And I guessed it, not knowing if I was right or not, because it was mime.
Yeah.
Well, years later, after he had language, he said the same thing over and over in different ways, but it was the same story.
And his, I don't think it's too much of a leap when we talk about his honesty and his observations about greed, if you will. How did this affect him monetarily? Did he have a job? Was he paid? And when he tried to spend his money, was he treated fairly? And did he know the difference?
That's an interesting question because, again, back to ethics, he doesn't understand our money system. And when I say he doesn't understand it, he understands it cognitively. He uh-huh. understands what a dollar is. He understands what a bank is. He understands what a check is. He can understand it in terms of taking a test and answering, but he is like a Martian in the sense of he doesn't understand it ethically. When I explained to him for the very first time that you could put money in a bank and there's something called a savings account and you would be getting interest, this man, without language, without education, said, that's not fair. He knew that money was coming from somewhere and it wasn't his. That, isn't that interesting?
That is
like,
interesting.
Out of the mouths of babes, right?
Yes.
That his take on, quote, investment, someone's getting screwed.
Well, it's more truth in that than not, I'm afraid.
That's why I mean, out of the mouths of babes. Yes. And so when I say he doesn't understand it, he understands what's going on, but he understands in a different way.
Yes.
That he doesn't whitewash it with, oh, I'm earning investment income for my family. Wait a minute, where does that investment income come from? Who are you hurting? And I just find that interesting. And back to what you were saying about being about how it's affected him, this observation of greed versus generosity or being content.
Mm-hmm.
This man doesn't understand, again, ethically doesn't understand clock in, clock out for breaks,
yes.
for lunch.
Uh-huh.
And he works on his own time because he loves, he makes gardens, beautiful gardens. And he, on his own time, with his own money, he buys extra things. He brings rocks from beaches and ranches and makes rock gardens. This is his stuff. His time, his gas money, hauling things in a truck.
Sure.
And he sneaks in, do work on weekends, and he's been told over and over he can't do that. And he's been trained, you know, he's been told about insurance. He understands cognitively. He doesn't understand. If he cares about the garden, if something needs watering on the weekend,
sure.
he's going to be there on a Saturday to water that poor plant. And he does not understand why people make such a big deal about my time versus the time when you're doing something that you're supposed to be loving. He loves his plants and his gardens. And yes, he's getting paid, but that's immaterial to what he wants to do with his life. He wants to go and water that poor tree, even if it's a Saturday and he's not getting paid to do it. And so he's in a different world. He's
yes.
certainly not an American capitalist.
After observing them. I don't know. Well,
he shares everything. He pays for other deaf people's, because a lot of deaf people don't get employment. And
uh-huh.
he pays for his poor deaf friends who are unemployed, pays for their dental bills, takes people to the hospital or pays for the medical bills.
Mm-hmm.
And he hates it if anyone knows that he's doing this.
Mm.
I found out because of signing to a friend of his while we were waiting for him. He would never have told me that.
Wow.
And I'm like, wow,
yes.
what do you think of this person? He just dismisses it. He waves his hand and he looks at me and says, that's what you're supposed to do.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what you're supposed to do. He does not have an me mentality
mm-hmm.
at all. So if he earns money and someone is unable to earn money for whatever reason, he shares with them.
Well, he's fascinating. And the more we talk about him, the more I listen to you. He's a fascinating human being. And the fact that we want to remind everyone that he didn't have any sense of language, not only not able to speak because he was deaf and therefore without anyone teaching him sign language or lip reading or anything like that, he had no concept of language as meaning, as a pragmatic thing even, until he was 27. And he meets you, and we should say, we're going to take a break before too long, but and we'll say this again later, but I just want to remind everyone, my guest today is Susan Schaller. She's the author of A Man Without Words, which has been made into a documentary by a former guest of mine, directed by Zachary Godshall, also the same title, A Man Without Words. And both you and your student appear in that documentary, right, Susan?
Yes, and if anyone wants a copy of the documentary and or a book.
Uh-huh.
I'm practicing the gift economy, so if you're a poor student, teacher, or just poor, or feeling poor, write me. You can write me through my website, susanschaller.com. That's Susan Schaller, one word, SusanSchaller.com. And I'll send you a book and or a DVD. And if you would like to give me a gift to buy more books and DVDs to give away, that's you.
That would be grand. I was hoping you would say that. That's where I was headed before we take a break, to make certain people know your name, the title of the book, or the title of the documentary and how they can get a hold of you and how they can get. And of course, there's nothing wrong with buying these things as well from Susan. that's permitted.
I learned from
Ildefonso. That's right. That's permitted as well. But it's just a phenomenal life, both yours and his. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about how you taught him, how you got through to him. As a former teacher, I teach teachers and say, the first thing you have to learn is that you have to go where the student is, that you can't expect them to hop over where you are. You have to go where they are, and then from there, you both walk back together. But this must have been quite a journey. We're going to take a short break. I'm Marcello Rolando. This is the Reasonable Voices Talk Radio Show. And I am talking to Susan Schaller, the author of A Man Without Words. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Not Fade Away would likely never have been made had it not been written and directed by David Chase, who enjoyed tremendous success with HBO's The Sopranos. This film was his passion project, a semi-autobiographical account of coming of age when flower power was in blossom. In Hollywood films, straight lines usually lead to tidy endings, but here we are focused on the arbitrary nature of life's offered path and the impossibility of perfection. Chase is known as a keen observer of important moments. He also loves and understands the power within the music of the 60s, an essential element in this story of friends forming a rock band and trying to make it big. But the path to be somebody is never an easy one, and human nature is a constant interference. This is the story of a confident young man beginning to discover there is no easy world where blissful dreams flower to abundance. Who is Not Fade Away for? For those who shared this special time. For those who experimented, who felt passion in the music, who would have changed the world with dream-perfect lovers at their sides, if only. We go on to other lives, but oh, what possibilities were once so real. Not Fade Away, not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices radio show, where reasonable voices get to share their ideas and dreams and goals and their lessons that they've learned in life so that we may learn from them as well. Speaking of which, we have a master teacher today, Susan Schaller, who is the author of A Man Without Words, which has been made into a documentary by the same title, A Man Without Words, directed by Zach Godshall. But Susan Schaller today is telling us about her student, who she refers to in her book as Ildefonso. Tell us now, I know we talked a lot about you and him last time, but tell us, how did you begin? How did you reach him and bring him into the world of language?
When I first met him, I didn't know, of course, what was different about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I introduced myself. He is deaf, and so I raised my hands and signed, "Hello, my name is Susan Schaller." And he did a strange thing. He raised his hands, and he tried to copy, "My name is Susan Schaller," and obviously didn't know what I was signing, and so it was a bad copy. And he's most likely descended from the Mayans, so he looks like a native Mexican. So I thought to myself, maybe this is Mexican Sign Language. Uh-huh. And then I kept thinking about it. If you spoke another language or signed another language, you wouldn't copy someone. That would be strange.
Yes.
You would basically, if you spoke Japanese and you didn't know any English and someone came up to you, you would understand most likely that it was a greeting, you know, if they weren't yelling at you. There are some universals in human behavior, such as introducing yourself. So that seemed very odd, and I kept trying to communicate, and very slowly I realized he had no language. So to your question, I'd like to refer back to what you said before the break, which is you cannot teach if you don't know where the student is and actually go to meet the student.
Yes.
And I always think of, help me with the name, is it Edward Abbey that wrote the book about the line trying to talk to a dot?
I didn't... you're breaking up just a little bit. I didn't quite understand the question. Edward Albee, the playwright?
I think it's Edward Abbey, I think is the name. And he wrote, I can't remember the name of the book. He wrote about a line, a little tiny book, wonderful little tiny book about a line trying to communicate to a point and trying to explain to a point what a line is. Well, so it's a wonderful little book. Anyway, it reminds me, I always think of that because if you don't understand language, I have to try to figure out what it's like to be languageless. I have to meet you in your space. So I actually devote a chapter in the book about that because it felt like he was in prison, a kind of prison, and I had to figure out how to get into his prison, so to speak, figure out where he is, and then lead him out.
Yes.
And that was extremely difficult. That was very, very difficult. In fact, it was... I would like to say it was the hardest job I ever had, but then I had twin babies, so I'm not so sure. twin babies might have topped it.
Yes. But you know, it does explain what you were saying in the last segment about how he doesn't want to talk about when he was without language, because he probably now sees it as a prison too. And why would he want to revisit it? I get that now. What did he do? Did he look at the mouths of people, the lips as they spoke, and sort of?
That's one of the most amazing things about him. I was attracted to his intelligence. He was obviously very intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, much more than that, was I was attracted to his perseverance. That 27 years, not knowing he was deaf, not knowing there was sound, not knowing what hearing or sound or a spoken language was, he thought that we all figured this lip movement stuff out visually. So he's staring at mouths. He's staring at mouths, trying to figure out what these lips are doing. And I couldn't believe that because I'm pretty sure that I would have given up, probably as a teenager or maybe earlier.
Mm.
I would, and I have met, quote, languageless, unquote, you know, people with little or no shared language who have given up. They're in a kind of, I suppose you'd call it a kind of insanity, a kind of autism. You know, not literally autism, but similar symptoms. You know, they just withdraw into their own little world because they don't know what's going on. And he didn't. He just kept trying.
Wow.
So back to the original question, how did I reach him? It was frustrating. He just tried to copy me with his hands and arms. And so I gave up, and I thought what attracted me was that he kept studying mouths even though he didn't understand what's going on.
Mm.
So I knew he would study me. So I broke eye contact with him, which to a deaf person means you're not talking to them. And I started teaching an invisible chair. And then I became, I'm an invisible student. I put a chair up, and I became the invisible student. I became the pretend student and pretended that I understood, but I didn't really understand. I'm sorry. I wrote CAT on the board, and then as a student, I'd go, oh, I get it, and I'd go up and I'd start petting the CAT on the blackboard, and then I'd become the teacher again, say, no, it's not a cat.
Excellent.
It's the idea of a cat, but I'm trying to mime this, and trying to, how do you do this? I'm trying to show that I was thinking. This is hard on the radio, because if you would be seeing me, I'm doing all kinds of gestures and facial expressions. I would be frowning and looking like I'm thinking, and then as if I took something from my head, throw it to you, and then I became the student, and I would catch it and put it in my head, and they go, oh, cat. So I tried to do that kind of stuff, which, like, how do you explain not only language without language, I mean, language with language, he doesn't know what language is, how do you explain what a word is by using words, how do you explain what signs are by using signs, but also... how do we know that thoughts are in the brain? Ancient Greeks, didn't they think we sort of thought with our stomach? You know, I mean, how do you know that? It's a cultural thing. It's something learned. So I wasn't even sure that that made any sense to him, that I'm doing all these thinking facial expressions and putting something in my head and trying to get it to someone else's head. That's
quite a leap, a leap of faith for sure.
At the time, I didn't think too much about it, but when I was writing the book, I thought, well, that was, you know, a lot of assuming on my part.
Yes. Wow. But he must have been fascinated. After all, he had been staring at people's lips, trying to figure out for 27 years what they knew that he didn't know. So he must have really been drawn to this new thing, you were putting in front of him. Did he latch on to it with the usual curiosity?
He was watching me and he was studying me. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes, especially when we went on for break or we left for the day, we both communicated our frustration non-verbally, mm-hmm. just our body language. We were just exhausted.
Sure.
And we looked frustrated and we looked tired and sad. And I think both of us wondered if we'd see each other ever again. You know, would he show up the next day? Why would he show up?
Mm-hmm.
You know, to just be frustrated. And why would I show up just to be frustrated? It was very, very time-consuming, hitting your head against a wall kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times that he withdrew. He would put his arms around himself, not in a natural position. It's like a kind of holding himself.
Oh, gotcha, yes.
Out of fear. Almost like he was his own straitjacket, you know, holding himself very, very tightly and wrapping his arms around him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a clue of him withdrawing, that he thought I was crazy or something. And so I never knew from day to day if I'd see him again. When I was almost ready to give up, meaning I was doing crazy things in my head, I had, in the book I write, you know, I had a Texan accent in one of my, you know, in my head, where I'd have this really slow drawl, or I'd, you know, I was doing crazy things in my head. It was getting boring, more and more boring to me. So I was close to giving up, and then his body posture changed, his facial expression changed, his eyes actually got wide, and as if he was looking at the world for the first time.
Mm. That aha moment.
Yeah. He had an aha moment. And the aha moment wasn't, oh, that's what language is, because he still didn't know what language
sure.
was. But the aha was, oh, everything has a name.
Yes.
And the name doesn't change from person to person or from day to day. Because he had the human capacity to make symbols. And he could make a symbol with you he might make a symbol for table.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day he might make a different symbol for table with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because we say table and chair, but if you look at tables and chairs, they differ quite a bit. A picnic
yes.
table versus a folding table versus a great big huge dining table.
Sure.
And so instead of making a new word for different kinds of tables, we have one word and it's can be used over and over with millions of people. And he didn't know that existed. So that was the aha moment. And I'm convinced after seeing other languages, people go through this aha moment, that that's the biggest aha moment. And it seems to me that's evidence for that's the beginning of human language, that we decide we're going to call this a mammoth instead mm-hmm. of acting it out all the time.
Yes. And save our energy. Use our brains, exactly, instead of charade. But you know, we can laugh now, but you've seen for yourself, that is probably how language began. I mean, we started off charades, we started off pointing at things, but at some point it just made sense to call it something.
And what the breakthrough also included what you talked about before, about how he was curious about what was going on, and he didn't have any idea of not only language, but what language did. How did it glue people together?
Yes.
How did it affect people? And when he realized everything had a name, and that's what people were trying to tell him, that this is called something, and that's called something, and you can do something with words or signs that are like pointing with a finger, but you can point to abstract things that a finger can't point to. And when he realized that, again, this is one of the most amazing things about language to me, is it does change the brain. And the way he looked at everything, this man is 27 years old, had all kinds of adult experiences, and yet he starts pointing to things and demanding names from me in signs. And it's as if he was looking at the table for the first time.
Mm.
What is that? What's that? And we see this in three-year-olds or two-year-olds
sure.
saying, what's that?
Yes.
And he was going through the what's that stage. But as a 27-year-old man with experience with a table, experience with a chair, and he's pointing to the wall and to the door and to the window, and his face is that of a foreigner, a tourist, seeing a new sight for the first time. I think that's, we have a relationship to names that's separate from our relationship to things.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, how was there even more joy when he found out there was a name for what he loved doing, gardening and rock gardens and watering plants?
Oftentimes, we have to go through pain before we get to joy. So the first reaction was out of pain.
Yeah.
And I think that it comes out in the documentary more than ever before. I used to say that I think it was him being overwhelmed with all that he had missed for 27 years, because he broke
yes.
down and started crying and started sobbing. I mean, really, really crying.
Sure.
And in the documentary, I asked him on the documentary what was happening, and he says it slightly differently. He says he remembers crying. He had been so frustrated. And so I'll explain it a little differently from what I've done in the past, because I realize it's a lot like if I was going to meet you and I don't know how to get around in Virginia, and I get lost, and I actually get quite lost, and
mm-hmm.
I'm spending hours and hours, and during those hours and hours, I'm getting hungry, I'm getting scared,
sure.
I'm getting, you know, all kinds of feelings, and then when I finally meet you, I break down and start crying.
Sure.
Because I'm safe, and I'm able to show vulnerability when I'm not out in the wild, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm safe. And I almost feel like that's what he experienced, that he was able to cry about all of his frustration because he was seeing the beginning of the end of the frustration, of the loneliness, of the prison that he had been in for 27 years.
Wow. It's such a story. It's just, wow. You are working on first of all, I don't think I even mentioned that you earned a master's in public health, by the way, everybody, in community education from UNC. If you're not already impressed by what Susan is telling us. But are you writing a play also by the same title, A Man Without Words?
There's been a play written, and I'm working with the playwright on cleaning up the script a little before we send it out and make it more public, because we had to change the script. It's been performed. The first performance was this is what brought me to North Carolina, at the App Summer Festival in Boone, North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
We worked on it together. So there is a playwright that wrote the play, and I was his assistant, not the writer.
Uh-huh.
And it's called Without Words, and it's fascinating. I loved what he did. So the play is different, as it should be. It's different
mm-hmm.
from the book, different from the film. Every medium can do something another medium can't.
Exactly.
Which I love. So that, you know, you can do something on the radio that you can't do on, you know, television, and you can do something in a play. I think theaters. I think, this is just my opinion, but somehow it's, for whatever reason, I think it's because you have a live audience, you can be more creatively outrageous or outrageously creative on stage than you can in a film or a book,
mm-hmm.
because you have people right there helping with the imagination and sort of, if you will, egging on the actors.
Exactly.
It was fascinating. I had never been behind the scenes, and so to be working with this cast, and back to, we had to change the script because we didn't have enough deaf people and enough hearing actors who knew signing, so we had to change some of the script so that those particular actors could do it well. And so now we're putting back things in the script before we send it out. Anyway, it was very successful. I got lots and lots of comments. It was rehearsed all through June
mm-hmm.
and July, and then we put it on at the end of July, or towards the end of July, in Tennessee and North Carolina, and I just loved watching the audience come to life. And as soon as you put an audience there, the actors who were doing a pretty good job in
yeah.
the last few rehearsals, it was just like a drug. You put
sure.
an audience there, and all of a sudden the actors did 10 times better, 100 times better.
Oh, yeah. Actors are like that. I'm a director primarily by profession, and I've directed a lot of theater, and when it just looks like, oh, they're not going to quite get there, I always tell people, no, don't worry. It's
yeah,
you, as the director, I give them all I can give them. The playwright's given them all he can give them on the page. But it's that last ingredient, and that's the audience. And you touched on something. It's not just the audience laughing and reacting and crying and applauding. It's the audience imagination. So it's all those different minds and life experiences that are relating to what the actor is saying and doing. And then when that all clicks out there somewhere in the lights and darkness, it's an amazing thing. So I'm glad you have experienced that, and with such a material. I mean, gee.
It was tremendous. I won't give the whole play away, because I think he being Derek Davidson, he's a professor in the theater department at Appalachian State University in Boone, and he's also a playwright with he and his wife have a little production company called Invisible Theater, and I love what they're doing, because they're taking marginalized, invisible people of all kinds and writing plays about them, making them visible. So, of course, a language-less deaf man is, and deaf people in general are invisible, and their plight is invisible, and the oppression of not being able to get language is it's horrible what happens to deaf people, and yet people don't realize how many deaf babies have to go years without any language because of a bias against sign language, against visual language. And even if you do cochlear implant, which is invasive brain surgery, even if you do speech reading, even if you do lots of other things, speech therapy, nonetheless, the baby is a human baby and needs language. Yes. A visual baby, of course, will learn a visual language faster and better and more naturally than a spoken language if they're born deaf or profoundly deaf. And then you can make them bilingual and you can do all kinds of things. But you can tell the two-year-old, oh, now I'm going to teach you English. It's something that we speaking people do.
And the
two-year-old will follow you. But if the two-year-old doesn't have any language, they're already behind for the rest of their life.
Yes.
And they don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. They think you're crazy. Well,
and so we that's what I'm talking about, the oppression of deaf people, and they're very misunderstood. And any deaf person who, quote, speaks out against the treatment of deaf babies, they're called militaristic, or they're called crazy. So that's one of the things we do to marginalize people. It's like, well, what's wrong with them?
Yes.
And instead of what can we learn from these beautiful visual actors, for example. So in the play we had, that was one of the themes. What do deaf people have instead of what they don't have?
Mm-hmm.
Have better visual communication than any of us hearing people. Any actor can learn from a deaf person on how to act as far as visual presentation, body language, facial expressions, and space and movement and lighting. I mean, they see better than we do. They do biologically see better, because if they're born with a major hearing loss or profoundly deaf, their brains, all of our brains are plastic at birth, and so their cortex literally uses more space, more cortex for visual information processing. So biologically, they are indeed superior to us in seeing. But we don't know that, because guess what? We can't see what they see.
Exactly. Exactly.
So why don't we learn about vision and visual art and all kinds of things from deaf people, instead of robbing them of language and an easy access into the human community?
Well, we couldn't end on a better note than that. I know I do want to mention again how we can get the book A Man Without Words by Susan Schaller, and it's just been an incredible conversation. You are just so the right person for this, to remind us all, and again that don't ask what's wrong with them, but what can I learn from them? And it sounds as though you and your student, your languageless man, have taught each other at least equally, wouldn't you say?
Oh, definitely. That's, as I said, he changed my life, and I changed his life. And one of the themes of all my work or life is that we always change each other.
Yes.
And sometimes we know it, like in a more dramatic story like this, but I'll just end with, someone has probably saved your life, almost undoubtedly saved your life in the last couple of weeks, because we drive these lethal things called automobiles.
Yes, yes.
And somebody was horsing around, and a passenger said, "Hey, Jim, pay attention, there's a pedestrian." And you were the pedestrian, and your life was saved by that passenger, and you don't even know it.
And you don't, exactly. It's true.
So we always affect each other's lives, whether we know it or not, and sometimes we don't know it for years, and sometimes we never know it. And it's obvious our parents, it's obvious some people, the Salk vaccine. You know, I mean, something's very obvious, but there's many, many, many ways that we affect each other, and our stories affect each other and change our lives. And that's one of the reasons why we need to listen to everybody and listen to all languages.
All right, we're going to have to go, but before we go, please tell us how we can get in touch with you and how we can get your book, A Man Without Words.
Well, write to me at susan@susanschaller.com, or just go to the website and you can write through the website, Susan Schaller, SusanSchaller, one word, .com. And I will send you a book, a DVD. I will give you a gift. And if you'd like to give a gift so I can buy more books, that's up to you. But I like practicing the gift economy because I think I learned that from Ildefonso. So we need to learn how to share more in order to build community and not have it all be about money and profit. So let's practice giving gifts to each other.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Susan. This has been Susan Schaller, our guest today, the author of A Man Without Words. And this has been a delightful, informative, educational, inspiring show today on The Reasonable Voices. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando. And Susan, I wish you all the best, and certainly to all with whom you come in contact. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Stay with us, as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Some well-known stand-up comedians are considered modern philosophers. George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, and Louis C.K., to name a few. Another is Bill Hicks, a truly great comic whose short life is documented in American, The Bill Hicks Story. Starting from humble beginnings in Houston, the film follows Hicks as he nurtures his craft in Texas, travels to Los Angeles to further his career, tours the United States, and then Great Britain. There, he becomes a national sensation through his uniquely acerbic, scorching, and insightful observations of the absurdities of the world around him. And us. Employing a mix of interviews with friends and family, footage of Hicks' performances, and animation, American paints a portrait of Hicks as a man who began as an entertainer but found his calling when he realized that if he talked about headier ideas, infusing them with his sometimes caustic, always in your face brand of dark humor, he could become an agent for change in the world. Hicks died of pancreatic cancer when he was only 32. A little-known comic in America, he came into his own overseas and became a megawatt outlaw star. The producers of this insightful doc seek to introduce America to one of its own greats, American, The Bill Hicks Story, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. The View and Nurses, Bigots and Candidates, Pope Francis and Cow Gas. At the very least, we owe ourselves the view that every ER demonstrates. We don't always need a doctor, but as with Ebola scare, nurses are healthcare front line. The view we need for respecting gender equality is 3 more states ratifying ERA and less Bill Cosby, an American view with less Fiorina and more Planned Parenthood. In 2015 and 2016, what together are we willing to contribute or sacrifice to free ourselves from racial prejudice, expanding its 21st century bigotry to focus politically on superficial differences in appearance, lifestyle, religion, and sexual preferences? Are you ready to stop waiting for someone to hand us the answers on a fast food tray? Are we ready with our votes, purchases, and rallies to start telling Wall Street, Congress, NSA, EPA, DOJ, and NRA what 47% to 99% of us want them to do? Are we ready to let go of being the bottom line speck on somebody's doormat? As nation, neighborhood, community center, place of worship, social media, and individual, let us begin. Prioritize mental health care and better gun purchase background checks.
Get informed and take responsible action, acknowledging climate change denial can ultimately lead to flooded countries as well as American states and climate wars. Educate police and public in campus and military rape prevention. Raise the minimum wage. Transform our mindset from fossil fuels to clean air and water. Become global citizens with humane student loan and immigration reform, not military conquest. Share our watchful eye on Wall Street bankers and oil barons with animal agriculture, because cow gas is even worse for our environment than BP, Shell, GM, Exxon, and Volkswagen. Or all of us pay the price for corporate fossil fuel greed and consumer red meat cravings. Almonds may not have transformed sunny California into the dried-up wild, wild west, but it is those who thrive on driving, growing, selling, buying, and overconsuming who fuel what endangers life on Earth. Like any American, I'm all for convenience at my fingertips and instant gratification with each directed remote or mouse click. So unless Papa can awaken the stewardship of Love Thy Neighbor as Thyself Nazarene in us, or unless we evolve from creators of food deserts devouring cheeseburgers into Mediterranean diet worshippers or devotees to reversing our grain brains, our destiny is being the frog simmering in a pot of dirty water of our own boiling. Deaf to the still small voice within, it is now crucial we hear the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, the new Peter, Pope Francis I, and be the change that rejuvenates Earth from exhaustive depletion and ourselves from overconsumerism. Why not stop living like overcrowded, penned-up pigs, gassing up on gas-producing cows, dining on dyed chemicals, coal ash water, parched food sources, fishless oceans, still driving gas guzzlers? It's not God's will that created smog inhalation or increasingly devastating hurricanes and tornadoes. It's free will. Without even noticing, have we become one of three kinds of Americans? Zealots believing ideology is more important than people? Humanitarians believing in the civility of the golden rule, feeling people are more important than ideology? The great manipulators who created the Great Recession. Whatever our politics or beliefs, let's not worship immigration bigots, nor Lehman Brothers, Hewlett-Packard merger mother partying over 30,000 layoffs, tinkling lies and videotape on PP. Facelift or not, the right is wrong for America. So let's daily resuscitate our civic duty by paying attention and getting involved, because climate change, like animal agriculture, is the reality show making our past our prologue. View the formula, 1980, Marlon Brando, George C. Scott. But feed on cowspiracy, because sometimes we want government to tell us only the part we want to hear. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of The Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.